Chapter 46 Profile Window Snyder. Muende Window Snyder has worked for a who's who of industry powerhouses. Early on, she worked at Stake as the director of security architecture. At Stake was a great vulnerability finding and computer security company that generated or acquired more than its fair share of computer superstars. It was eventually acquired by Symantec in 2004. Snyder went to work for Microsoft in 2002 and was a senior security strategist in the Security Engineering and Communications Group. She was a contributor to the Security Design Lifecycle, SDL, and co-developed a new methodology for threat modeling software. She also was a security lead on Microsoft Windows XP Service Pack 2, which was basically Microsoft's first serious attempt at a secure-by-default operating system, and Windows Server 2003. She managed the relationships between security consulting companies and Microsoft and was responsible for its computer security community outreach strategy. She joined Mozilla in 2006 and used the humorous tongue-in-cheek title of Chief Security Something or Other, instead of the more formal Chief Security Officer, CSO. I remember many of us being quite jealous of the title. She eventually worked for Apple as a senior security product manager, developing security and privacy strategy and features for iOS and OS X. Today she works for Fastly, fastly.com/, a content delivery network that is quickly expanding into other services such as computer security. Snyder is the daughter of an American father and a Kenyan-born mother, and co-author, along with Frank Swiderski, of the book Threat Modeling. Amazon.com/threat-modeling-microsoft-professional-swiderski/dp/07356-19913/. She is the only person I personally know who has worked inside three of the four largest companies that provide very popular browsers and software. She's been in the trenches, so to speak. I had to start off our interview by asking about her name. She replied, "I can tell you a story about when I used to work at Microsoft. Back then, by default, most people's email addresses began with their first name, followed by their last initial. But a large distribution group, the Windows Product Group, already had Windows, which would have been my email alias if mine had followed the defaults. Over the years, many people would be trying to send something to me private or confidential, maybe it was about malware or a new vulnerability report, and instead of sending it to me, they would accidentally send it to one of our largest email distribution groups. They might eventually realize their mistake when the email bounced off the locked distribution list." Then I asked her how she got into computer security. She said, "I was a computer science major and got interested in cryptography and cryptoanalysis. I was interested in the idea of secrets bound by the difficulty of a mathematical problem. It was around the same time I first had access to multi-user operating systems. I started thinking about the security boundaries between different users and their processes, and what prevented them from interfering with each other or the operating system. What I found was that back then, at best, there were semi-permeable barriers. It was fun, like taking apart a puzzle or machine and finding out how it worked. It was an exciting time." I knew she had been involved in the Security Design Lifecycle, SDL, while at Microsoft. I wondered how that happened and what she did. She replied, "When I first got to Microsoft, it wasn't very mature in computer security at all. There were something like only 11 employees. I was the 12th, concentrating at Windows Security. And back then, it was mostly reacting to what other outside people found. There wasn't a strong internal program. Then SQL Slammer and Blaster hit. I helped by co-creating the first core methodologies of formal threat modeling." And she co-authored a book on the same subject. "I helped start proactive bug finding and reaching out to the community. When I first got to Microsoft, if someone externally found a security bug, Microsoft called them a hacker. The media at the time conflated hackers of all sorts with criminals. The people reporting issues to Microsoft, even dropping them unpatched publicly, were not criminals. I helped to push an outreach program to make them our allies instead of our adversaries. One of those improvements was to call them security researchers instead of hackers, to focus on how their work was a valuable contribution. I also helped create a program within Microsoft to sponsor many small external hacking conferences, like Hack in the Box. We were able to eventually change the perception that Microsoft didn't care about security or know about security, and these security researchers in Microsoft were on the same team. When I first got to Microsoft, there was no one representing security for the Windows product, so I stepped in. I represented security at the Windows War meetings, where all the different sponsors and stakeholders came together. We had a huge backlog of bugs that we were solving whack-a-mole style, and that was not efficient. As part of SDL, we started to look at the larger causes of bugs, trying to find broader categories that if we fixed, would mitigate a whole lot of bugs at once. We took the lessons learned with the Windows security team and started to move them out to other teams and products, like to Microsoft Office. I asked her to name another valuable lesson she learned and pushed. She replied, "There is an entire financial ecosystem behind today's malware. You have one set of people finding vulnerabilities, and another set of people who turn that vulnerability into an exploit and kit. You have another set dedicated to infecting as many websites and hosts as they can with that exploit kit, and then another set that uses it to accomplish some goal. But if you take a link out of that malware ecosystem chain, it makes it harder for the rest to do business. If you can do some things that make key points in the ecosystem more difficult or more expensive, then the whole chain is harder to build." Microsoft and Windows didn't catch that early enough. When I joined Microsoft, they were already experiencing an onslaught of malware, worms, and viruses. I later went to work on other platforms, including iOS and OS X at Apple, and used my experience to successfully put roadblocks that made the malware ecosystem less likely to develop and be profitable. If you can undermine the economics of malware, you can win that way too. Snyder worked at some of the most well-known big companies. I wondered what commonalities she saw in corporations that were so very different. She said, "In all the companies, you have to make security work for the end users. Security features that come at too big of a cost, that interrupt their normal workflow too much, aren't going to work. We need to implement more and better security, but not get in the way of the user's workflow. Also, don't collect the data you don't need. If you collect the data, you have to protect it and give users control over their own data. The biggest problem in computer security is successfully executing the things we already know how to do." Spoken like an experienced industry insider. For more information on Windows Snyder. For information about Windows Snyder, check out these resources. Windows Snyder's LinkedIn profile. LinkedIn.com/IN/window. Windows Snyder on Twitter. Twitter.com/window. Chapter 47. Writing as a career. I failed high school English twice. In grad school, while doing a hospital administration internship, the writing of my first corporate report was so bad that the boss questioned out loud our nation's entire education system. When I occasionally reread that report to remind me of where I started, it physically hurts me. Almost 30 years later, I've authored or co-authored 9 books and nearly 1,000 national magazine articles on computer security, and I've been the InfoWorld magazine computer security columnist going on 12 years. All thanks to my brother, the first and best real writer in the family, my personal perseverance, and a slew of quality editors. While I still have a hard time writing an email without a typo, my writing has improved enough that I make a very good living doing it. I frequently do writing assignments where I can earn up to $500 to $1,000 an hour, and I make more in 1 year than the average American family income. And it's only my side job. Although I work full-time as computer security consultant, I've been writing about computer security even longer. It's nice supplemental income that I can make writing in spare cycles at home, while flying and at nights in hotel rooms after consulting all day. Some people watch TV at night. I usually write while watching TV. My writing hobby has funded many a grand family vacation and allows me to spend way too much money on my hobbies. I'm not alone. Hundreds of people around the world make their entire living writing about computer security. From the comfort of their home, with a decent internet connection, they provide a good living for themselves and their families. Some work for established media giants, and others freelance, selling their articles and services to interested parties. Some write books, and most blog and write articles. They all have a passion for computer security, filtering out the vendor's marketing hype, and revealing the truth to readers in a more understandable way. Computer security writing outlets. There are many ways to write about computer security, including those described next. Blogs. Most computer security writers either have a permanent blog location or participate in several blogs. Blogs are essentially today's modern version of magazine articles. Blog postings may or may not be paid, and may or may not have an editor to help check and correct the content before posting. Personal blog sites and posts are very easy to start, although the biggest issue is attracting readers and keeping up the work over the long term. The vast majority of blogs are started and ended within a single year, when the writers either don't get the readership they desire, or they've said everything they are passionate about. Blogging, like writing magazine articles, is hard work to do well. If you are interested in a personal blog and don't know where to start, check out one of the many popular blogging sites, of which WordPress, WordPress.com, is the uncontested leader at this time. WordPress, created and maintained by a hip company known as Automattic, powers 27% of all internet sites and something like 70% of all blog sites. Social media sites. Most computer security writers have a Twitter site to which they post occasionally or daily. Secondarily, they may have professional and personal sites at Facebook, LinkedIn, or Google Groups. Many writers maintain sites in all of these locations, in addition to their other professional publication locations. Articles. Most professional computer security writers write articles, which typically means writing content ranging from a few hundred words to many thousands of words. The average column length is somewhere around 1,000 words. The articles may end up being published in print magazines, in online publications, or as part of a blog site. Article topics can be in the categories of news, opinion pieces, tutorials, or product technical reviews. If you like writing and get lucky, you might even get a weekly or monthly column. Although before taking on a regular writing assignment, make sure you are up to the task. I remember how excited I was to get my weekly column with InfoWorld magazine back in August 2005. I couldn't wait to tell the world everything I thought and was passionate about. It turns out, you can tell the world everything you are really passionate about in about 12 articles. After that, you have to figure out a rhythm of generating new ideas each time a column is due. Sometimes I wake up at 4 a.m. and write 3 columns. Other times, I'm struggling to think of a new, interesting article or angle until well after my deadline. Most routine writers burn out, so if you want to make it a career, figure out a creative routine that works for you and your employer. Books. Books are a wonderful way of sharing what you know and even validating your own skills as a writer. I still haven't come down from the joy of getting my first book contract, after years of trying and more than 100 rejection letters, and the feeling of holding my first book in my arms. When you are a book author, there's a good chance your obituary will probably say, "Book author." No one can take it away. With that said, unless you find a way to successfully marry international intrigue, vampires, zombies, and computer security, preferably with a teenage protagonist, you're unlikely to get rich writing a book. The vast majority of computer security books never earn their authors more than $10,000. This wasn't always the case, but it has been since internet search engines became popular, and people can just look up things for free. There are exceptions. I know a handful of computer book authors who made hundreds of thousands of dollars and were able to buy boats and beach houses. Just don't decide to write a book because you think you're going to get rich doing it. Do it because you think you have an interesting idea that will appeal to tens of thousands of readers in a way that can really help make their lives and careers easier, if not more enjoyable. However, although writing a computer book might not make the average author rich, it does almost always lead to better-paying jobs. Being a book author gives you credibility, much like a college degree or certification does, but often even more so. The average computer book author I know makes far more money than non-authors. And again, I can often make more in a few hours of work than most people make in a week or two of work. This from a guy who failed English twice. Self-publish or publishing house. If you're going to write a book, you will need to decide whether you want to self-publish or go with a publishing house, assuming you can get through the discerning process of getting selected by a publishing house. It can be difficult for first-time book authors to get a book contract, where there are guaranteed and ongoing shared payment arrangements. Many authors, first-time and otherwise, decide to self-publish, partly because they want a higher proportion of the profits for each sold book. More often, many authors decide to self-publish after not getting accepted at a publishing house. It can be very difficult. If every author can be guaranteed to make a higher percentage of profit from each self-published book versus using a publishing house, I'm sure some listeners are wondering why anyone would decide to go with a publishing house at all. Well, for a lot of reasons. The average book author spends roughly a year, some less, some more, writing a book. If you're not lucky enough to do it full-time for a living, it means sacrificing every spare moment you have for a year. You end up neglecting family members, missing fun parties, and, in general, being stuck in front of a computer way more than you already are as a computer security professional. For all that effort, you want your book to be good. A book put out by a publishing house is far more likely to be a better product in the end. Self-published books rarely sell more than a few dozen copies, especially in the computer security field, and are usually just not as professional-looking as books published by publishing houses. The very act of having to qualify for being accepted by a professional publishing house makes you, your writing, and the book better. Plus, the publishing house will take over the non-writing parts of the book, which can be substantial. Before writing this book, I wondered if I should self-publish for the first time, but then I realized that writing the chapters and handing them over to the publisher, who handled the editing, technical editing, professional graphics, marketing, and distribution, and actual professional creation of the final product, meant that I could spend much more time with my family and doing things I loved besides writing and computer security. For example, instead of having to create a front and back book cover from scratch, the editor sent over several mock-ups, all done more professionally and creatively than I could have done. I simply chose the ones I liked and sent back a reply. It literally took 1 minute instead of days or weeks of work, and it came out better. On top of that, The professional editors you will get with a publishing house are probably way better than your loved one or friend doing it as an unpaid favor. I think going with a professional publishing house probably saves you half the effort otherwise, and has a far greater chance of making a better product with more sales than self-publishing. With that said, if you are a devoted professional and don't mind the extra effort, self-publishing is a viable alternative for those willing to put in the extra work. Unfortunately, the self-publishing world is full of half-crocked works with more typos than average. This is not to say that publishing house books don't have errors, but in general, they have far fewer. If you're interested in getting a book at a professional publishing house, go to their website and find their book proposal format. Take your time when filling it out. It should usually take you a few days. Submit it to their acquisitions email address or the person who handles such things. If you are a first-time book author and want to get accepted faster, hook up with a book agent who specializes in the types of books you want to write. They can help refine your idea and book proposal, and in my experience, they are almost always successful in getting you a book contract. I haven't always used a book agent, but when I have, I use Studio B, StudioB.com. It was well worth the small percentage cut they took from my books or other contents' royalties. Technical editor. Long before I was a published book author, I was a technical editor reviewing books headed toward publishing. I still do it today. A lot of computer security book writers start this way. It's a great chance to learn how the process works, what is expected of authors, and how to avoid the common mistakes that first-time book authors make. Newsletters. There are dozens of daily, weekly, and monthly computer security newsletters you can write for. It can be hard to get accepted by some of the more established magazines and newsletters that have been around for a while. Many don't accept any new unsolicited writings, while the other, less established newsletters are begging for free writers. Newsletters can be a great place to build your writing chops and writing resume to help you get other higher-paying gigs. White papers. In my experience, vendor-sponsored white papers are often where the easier big money is. Vendors often offer top dollar for 5 to 10 page white papers. Some of the topics I have been paid for come easily to me, and I end up writing the whole white paper in a few hours. Others require more research and interviews end up taking many weeks. But in general, you can earn the same money for a few white papers with far less effort than writing a book. The catch-22 is that many times it is being a published book author that gets you the white papers in the first place. Although, remember that ethically, if you have ever gotten paid by a vendor to do promotional work for them, you must always disclose that in any other writing involving the same vendor or its competitors. Technical reviews. The toughest writing I've ever done is technical product reviews. This is where you review one or more products, looking to remove the vendor's ever-present hype, and report to readers about the capabilities of the real product. Product reviews take days or weeks to complete, and often involve simulation test labs and interviews with real customers. For all that effort, they don't usually pay as much as easier-to-produce white papers. With that said, a good technical review can be far more fulfilling and helps more people. I try to do a few each year when I see either a promising product or overly hyped products that readers are interested in. Conferences. Once you begin writing for a living, you might start to get involved in giving presentations at conferences. It took me 2 decades to get over my nearly crippling stage fright, but I can seriously say that presenting at conferences is some of the most fulfilling work I've ever done. You not only get to share your insights as an authority on a topic that you care about, but you'll meet tons of like-minded people, get additional job opportunities, and often discover facts you did not previously know. Of course, presenting requires additional skills, such as the ability to create good slideshows and developing a good presentation style. Many conferences have pre-conference workshops to help new and experienced presenters to improve their presentation and speaking skills. Professional writing tips. After nearly 3 decades of writing, I can offer listeners a few pieces of advice, including those described in the following sections. The hardest part is starting. I've had hundreds of people come up to me over the years and ask how to professionally write. I always give them lots of information and recommendations. In that time, maybe a handful of people have followed through and even tried. Professional tech writing isn't easy, or at least not until after you've been doing it a while. Simply starting is the hardest part. If you want to be a professional writer, part-time or full-time, you need to start writing and putting in the effort it takes to get published. Sure, you need to have the knowledge of your subject and be able to write decently, but as I have shared, some of that can be learned along the way. If you are not a strong writer, pick up some books on grammar and writing, more than one. Read differently. Much as a professional musician listens to music differently than a regular fan, writers should look at other writing to pick up ideas, hints, and tricks. Start reading articles, looking to see how the writer did what they did. What was the way they introduced the story? What was the opening sentence? How did they cover the material? Was it interesting? Did they use graphics and when? How did they do it? If you're going to be a professional writer for a living, start noticing the bricks in the foundation of the house. Also, if you like a particular author's writing style, start following the writer to see what else they have done. One of the biggest clues that you're interested in a particular writing style is when you start to follow your favorite writers because you know they are above average for delivering information the way you want to read it. Start out free. It is the rare writer who gets paid for their first writing assignment. Most of us have to put in our time in the trenches, so to speak. If you're hoping to be a new professional writer, look for the less obscure newsletters and blogs to see if they will take unsolicited articles and ideas, and make multiple pitches. As you build up your writing chops and experience, you can start to increase what you ask for. Although remember, different types of writing pay differently. It isn't always about the initial money. Each bit of writing gains you credibility. Be professional. Lastly, it goes without saying that in the professional writing industry, being professional goes a long way. That means being prepared and knowledgeable, but also meeting deadlines. Every editor and publisher in the industry has horror stories of people they gave a writing contract to who never finished the book or article. Early on, I doubted my ability to write, and that led to missed deadlines. I've learned that simply meeting deadlines can get you lots of other paid work. Oftentimes, when a publisher or editor meets you for the first time, they are trying to figure out whether you will be reliable and professional. If you can convey professionalism, you can become a professional writer. If you do it over time, you can do it for a career. Be your own publicist. Regardless of whether you self-publish or use a professional organization, you'll need to expend as much effort as you can on getting your work seen by more people. That's why most professional security writers have presences on many different social network sites. The more people you know, the greater the chance that you can make a living at writing. A picture is worth 1,000 words. I give thanks to my longtime friend and best-selling professional IT author, Mark Manassi, Manassi.com, for this hint. Try to get your profile picture included with your writing anytime you can. Readers will remember you far more easily if you help them associate an image with your name. Early on, I told websites that I would write for free, even if they were offering to otherwise pay, if I could get my picture next to the article. This helps to build name recognition and followers faster, which leads to everything else. The ego-fulfilling side effect is that sometimes complete strangers will walk up to you and say they enjoy your work. My books never overly impressed my daughters, but the occasional fan walking up to us in a restaurant or amusement park and recognizing and thanking me did. As a full-time computer security consultant, I'm not only a writer, but writing has definitely made me a better consultant. When you write, you have to learn your subject really well and become a near master. It forces you to learn and exercise your brain in ways that you otherwise would not. I like to think that being a computer security consultant helps me be a better writer, and being a writer helps me be a better computer security consultant. At least, in my case, it isn't coincidental. The next chapter profiles Fahmida Y. Rashid, a senior writer and colleague at InfoWorld magazine. Chapter 48. Profile. Fahmida Y. Rashid. I've been a technical computer security journalist for almost 30 years. While I'm not the best writer, I do consider myself one of the better technical writers in that I live and breathe my subject. When I read other computer security writers' work, I don't usually learn much. That changed when I was introduced to a new writer at InfoWorld magazine by our editor-in-chief, Eric Knorr. Eric was very excited about hiring her, and I soon knew why. Like computer security journalist Brian Krebs, profiled in Chapter 29, Fahmida Y. Rashid is an incredible computer security researcher, although in a different way. I've yet to read a single article of hers where I do not learn something new. She groks her subject in a way that continues to surprise me for someone who isn't doing computer security as their day job. She really understands the technical details and is able to ferret out the BS better than anyone in the game. She occasionally sends me technical questions about something she doesn't understand, to which I almost always reply, "I don't know either." But a few days later, after more research, she is publishing an easy-to-understand explanation. She finds her answer somewhere. She is an experienced information security journalist. She has worked at eWeek as the senior technical editor for the CRN Test Center, covered network infrastructure for Forbes.com, served as editor-in-chief for an RSA conference, and written for dozens of respected magazines and websites, including Dark Reading, PCMag.com, Security Week, Tom's Guide, InfoWorld, SC Magazine, Dice.com, BankInfoSecurity.com, and GovInfoSecurity.com. She is currently a senior writer at InfoWorld Magazine, and she also works at Pragmatic Bookshelf, helping to guide authors through the process of writing technology books. I asked Rashid how she got started in computer security. She replied, "I actually started out as a network technician and help desk support for students, faculty, and administrators in a large urban university. I learned a lot about securing the network while juggling BYOD challenges even before the acronym became a security buzzword. I learned web server administration the hard way while working as a cold fusion developer for a dot-com startup, and someone hacked into the IIS server and deleted files. I spent 6 years as a management consultant for various financial services firms and pharmaceutical companies, developing Java applications, building large data warehouses, and manipulating large data sets. While I enjoyed the work, I wanted to take a step back, have a broader view of the technology world, and not just see the network of one company. I joined the journalism world as an enterprise technology reporter, writing about networking, storage, and hardware. All my technical experiences came in quite handy because I actually understood the technology I was writing about. Security became a logical extension of my focus because it is really difficult to write about networking and not think about security. After about 5 years, I started specializing in information security. A part of it was serendipity, as the increasing number of high-profile attacks, insider leaks, and the rise in online credit card fraud meant I had to spend more of my time focusing on security. I understood networking so I could see the gaps which made the attacks possible. I started learning about SQL injection and XSS, and I really hoped that none of my code from my consultant days was still in production, because I know I didn't sanitize any inputs. I've written for both business and consumer audiences, and learned the groups look at security very differently. But over the years, I am pleased to see that more and more people are actually thinking about security and not just dismissing it as something the techies deal with. I asked Rashid what she thought was the biggest issue in computer security. She replied, "I think the biggest issue is that being secure is hard. It requires new habits, and we don't have the time or patience to develop them. It doesn't have to be easy or convenient, but when security is confusing, the benefits aren't all that obvious, and we have people just looking for workarounds. Every single problem we have in security boils down to the fact that it's hard to do things the secure way, and much easier to just keep everything open and unprotected. Some examples: encryption makes sense, but it's still too difficult to use regularly. WhatsApp takes care of it automatically, so now people don't mind using encrypted chat. But secure file sharing and encrypted email are still too hard. We don't think twice about locking the door of our homes, but there must have been a time when people thought it was crazy. We are in that state right now where people think all the security steps are crazy, but the mindset is slowly shifting. But to really make that change, we need better tools. On the other hand, I know too many people with iPhones who still don't use Touch ID to lock their phones. So I don't know how much further we have to go on the not hard path for people to care. Maybe we need to get to the point where iPhones automatically record the user's fingerprints without having to set up Touch ID manually. We need security by default, where doors lock themselves automatically without our having to get the keys out. Skynet may be the answer to all our security woes." As a longtime successful computer security journalist, I asked Rashid what she would recommend to other people considering a career in computer security writing. She said, "While I don't think you need to have a technical background to be a good writer, it helps. I am not saying to go out and become a CISSP, write code, or learn how to use Metasploit. But learn the basics of how networks work, how computers and other devices communicate, and what some of the common terms mean. If you are going to be looking at web application attacks, have a flowchart-level understanding of how web applications, web servers, and databases interact. If you are going to write about DDoS attacks or its smaller cousin, DOS, you need to have a basic comprehension of how a network works. You don't need to know the mathematics behind cryptography, but understand the difference between some of the different implementations and understand why some should not be used. Read. Look at the technology. Don't shy away from understanding how technology works. You can't explain to people why we need to have more security over our digital lives and to protect our tech if you are scared of the technology. Think about it this way. You don't need to be an airline pilot to write about the aviation industry, but it would help if you've at least flown on some planes. Another important thing to remember is that technology tends to go in waves. What used to be old becomes new again with a tweak or new feature. The number of young writers who don't know about mainframes or dismiss mainframes as no one uses them anymore is frightening, because so much of our world still has mainframes at the foundation. Information rights management is making a comeback again. And every time I hear people talk about mobile devices and data in the cloud, I think back to the dawn of thin client computing. Knowing the past is always important, but it really makes a difference when looking at security because you can then see patterns. I asked her what she knows now that might have helped in her career if she learned it years sooner. She replied, "Don't be afraid to ask questions. I had this feeling that in order to have security researchers and experts take me seriously, I had to already be well-versed in the basics. So I spent a lot of time doing homework to try to get to the basic understanding. It took a long time to realize that experts are dying to be asked questions so that they can brag about their knowledge. You still need your basic knowledge. Don't ask your source what a DDoS attack is. But you can ask for explanations such as the difference between a Layer 4 and Layer 7 DOS attack. Much of my security basics started out as self-taught. And if I'd asked for help sooner, I could have learned much more thoroughly, as opposed to cramming, without nearly half the stress. Also, be skeptical of words like innovative, first ever, and market leading. In fact, when looking at security announcements, cross out the buzzwords so that you can see the basic message. I asked Rashid what she liked about writing about computer security. She replied, "I like computer security because it forces me to keep learning. There is always new research to read and new ways of tackling the problem to learn about. Security blends creative problem solving, curiosity about the world, and a willingness to break something to make something better. It's also about ego. Security professionals are the people who get up every morning intent on saving the world, one piece of data and device at a time. They may not get the millions that the Instagram founders get or the fame of Elon Musk, but the people who keep my data safe in corporate databases make sure the SSL certificate on the website is up to date so that my financial information is transferred securely across the web, and test code to make sure there is no one gaping remote code execution flaw in the software are the ones saving the world for us. I like writing about information security because it puts me tangentially in the orbit of those heroes." For more information on Fahmida Y. Rashid. For information about Fahmida Y. Rashid, check out these resources. Fahmida Y. Rashid's LinkedIn profile. linkedin.com/in/FY Rashid. Fahmida Y. Rashid's InfoWorld articles. infoworld.com/author/Fahmida-Y.Rashid. Chapter 49. Guide for Parents with Young Hackers. Note: some of this chapter originated from an article I wrote in 2016, 11 Signs Your Kid is Hacking and What to Do About It. infoworld.com/article/308-8970/security/11-signs-your-kid-is-hacking-and-what-to-do-about-it.html. As a computer security writer for over 20 years, a few times each year I have parents email to ask how they can tell if their kid is hacking, the bad kind of hacking, and what they can do to encourage their child's pursuit of a promising, honest career. I know what they are talking about because years ago, I had to have the same confrontation with my teenage son. He was starting to do some not-so-legal hacking, and in some cases was getting into minor trouble. Luckily, my wife and I intervened early and, with a few wrinkles, successfully encouraged his exploration of white hat hacking. I think that many smart computer teenagers have the ability to turn to the black hats if not appropriately guided. Often they either aren't doing great in school or aren't deriving much satisfaction from their scholarly accomplishments. At school and likely at home, they are being told to do what they consider to be boring tasks without a purpose, and they feel like they are being harassed for not working toward their full potential. In the online world, they seek and get the admiration and respect of their peers. They feel powerful and mysterious at the same time. It's like a drug. I get the attraction. Most of these kids are good kids and will get over their black hat hobby without getting into trouble. The problem is you can't be sure whether your kid will do so or not, so it's best to intervene before they have to learn how hard it is to get a job with a felony record. Signs your kid is hacking. Before you can counsel your kid into using their hacking skills for only ethical and good things, you must first figure out if they are hacking maliciously in the first place. After you've ruled out that their secrecy is only related to pornography or a girlfriend or a boyfriend, there are some signs your kid is involved in malicious hacking. The following sections explore these signs. Note: obviously, there are many things that can concern a parent about what their kids might be doing online, such as viewing pornography, going into chat rooms with predators, and engaging in other activities that can be troubling, dangerous, or illegal. Each of those concerns is serious and can be addressed through various means. But our focus for this chapter is specifically on the dangers of hacking. They tell you they hack. This one is pretty simple. Your child tells or brags to you about how easy hacking is. I know it sounds funny, but some parents hear this direct claim, often multiple times, and ignore it. They either don't understand what hacking really means in the way their child is using it, or they want to believe that their previously good kid isn't doing anything stupid or wrong. Unfortunately, sometimes they are. Overly secretive about their online activities. Every teenager wants 100% privacy for everything they do, online and otherwise, regardless of whether that includes hacking. A kid who is hacking will go to even greater lengths than usual to hide everything they do. What I'm talking about is a complete erasure of everything they do online. Their browser history is always blank. Their log files are clear. You can't find new files or folders. Everything is hidden. The absence of any activity is a big sign that they are intentionally hiding something that might get them into big trouble. By the way, clearing the browser history could be hiding other types of activities, so I'm talking about doing more than just that. They have multiple email/social media accounts you can't access. It is common for kids to have multiple email and social media accounts. It's the issue of inaccessibility that is important in this instance. If your kid has an email and social media account that they're comfortable with you reading, but you discover signs that they have other accounts and logons that they keep secret from you, something is going on. You find hacking tools on the system. If you find hacking tools like the ones described in this book, or that are generally found on hacking websites, then there's a good chance your kid is interested in hacking. People complain you are hacking. Several times during the period when my son was into computer hacking, I received emails and calls from strangers or my internet provider warning me that if I continued my hacking activities, I would have my internet connection terminated, or I would even face criminal and civil actions and fines. I was confused at first. I wasn't hacking anyone, but my son was. You catch them switching screens every time you walk into the room. They could be switching screens when you enter the room to hide any of many things, like watching pornography or communicating with a girlfriend/boyfriend. But if you catch them always switching screens when you walk into a room, investigate. These signs could be normal. All of these signs could be normal. Your kid may not be a malicious hacker or any kind of hacker for that matter. I'm sure lots of listeners and their children are listening to this right now and saying that each of those things listed earlier happened and they were not involved in illegal or unethical hacking. I get that. I'm just trying to share some of the signs that your kid might be hacking, so you won't be caught blindsided like my wife and I were, just as many of the readers who write me were. Awareness is a good thing. Not all hacking is bad. In fact, most hacking is good. Hacking is simply someone going beyond the standard confines of a GUI, or what the average computer user does. I'm a hacker, and I've never done anything illegal in my life. This applies to many of my coworkers, although a few did walk on the dark side for a while when they were younger. If you think your kid is hacking, you need to determine whether they are doing something unethical or illegal before tearing into them and taking away their computer privileges. Most of our most valuable companies and their leaders and employees have the hacking ethic. It's just a question of making sure it's ethical and legal hacking. How to turn around your malicious hacker. So, suppose that you discover your kid is engaged in unethical or illegal hacking activity. What can you do? First, understand that these kids can be reformed. Most go on to give up illegal activities as they mature and find fulfillment with better-paying, legitimate work. Only a few go on to make a career out of black hat activities. The key is to help guide these kids who know they are doing wrong to use their newly found skills for good. Second, let them know that you know what is going on and that it is unethical, illegal, and could lead to their arrest. The days when companies and authorities were clueless entities that rarely arrested someone are ancient history. Hackers are arrested and prosecuted all the time. It happened to some of my son's friends. I have talented, competent coworkers whose criminal record prevents them from accompanying me on certain high-profile engagements to this day. Third, tell your kid that you will be monitoring their activities for as long as you feel it is necessary. Let them know that you won't give them details about what you'll be doing, but that you'll be watching. And warn them that if you catch them engaging in the slightest unethical or illegal activities, every electronic device they have will go bye-bye for a long time. Threaten them with taking away whatever is their other favorite activity. Now is the time to scare them a little and to let them know there are consequences. And if they break the rules, be sure to follow up on your threats. Move their computers into the main living area and monitor. If your kids had computers in their room, tell them they have lost the privilege and move them into the main living area for easier monitoring. Tell them they can't use their computers when you're not home and not monitoring. Tell them these new changes will be permanent until you can trust them again. Make sure you monitor what they are doing even when they are in front of you. Give guidance. In addition to the forfeitures and potential punishments, most of all, give guidance. Have conversations with your kid about the importance of ethics, both online and offline. Explain how any hacking activity is illegal without being granted explicit permission by the legal owner or custodian of the data. Explain to them that even questionable hacking activity, such as uninvited port or vulnerability scanning, can be illegal, and even in the instances when it is legal, it is still unethical. Give legal places to hack. If your kid is interested in hacking, give them legal and ethical places to express that creativity and learn. There are a variety of places where they can do this. HackMe websites. There are all sorts of websites on the internet that allow and even encourage hacking. Search these locations out. One of my favorite sites is Hack This Site, hackthissite.org/. You can hack their website, and it includes tons of groups and projects dedicated to hacking. Another site dedicated to hackers of all types, not just computer hackers, is Hackerspaces, hackerspaces.org/wiki/. Bug bounty programs. Many vendors offer bug bounty programs where legal hacking can turn into thank yous or big bucks. Some vendors pay several hundreds of thousands of dollars for the biggest critical bugs and have already paid out millions of dollars in bounties. Many young adults have earned thousands of dollars by reporting bugs, including this one. PCMag.com/article2/0,28172,237139100.asp-title=12-year-old%20earns%20$3,000 percentage 20, bug percentage 20, bounty percentage 20, from percentage 20, Mozilla. Many prominent bug bounty programs exist. Microsoft's bug bounty program is here. technet.microsoft.com/n-us/library/dn425036.aspx. Google's program is here. google.com/about/appsecurity/reward-program/. Apple has an invitation-only program, but will still pay for bugs reported by outsiders. Mozilla's bug bounty program is here. mozilla.org/n-us/security/bug-bounty/. HackerOne, HackerOne.com, is the company that coordinates the bug bounty programs for many companies, such as Twitter, Slack, and Airbnb. Not every vendor has a bug bounty program, but all the smart ones do. Hardware hacking. If your kid is more interested in hardware than software, there are plenty of hacking outlets. They can join some of the IoT hacking groups covered in Chapter 35 and learn how to hack real-life IoT devices, or start with a basic hardware hacking kit like Raspberry Pi. RaspberryPi.org/. Raspberry Pi is essentially a little tiny Linux kit computer on a single circuit board. Over 10 million units have been sold. Arduino, arduino.cc/, is another similar product. Long gone are the days where the best you can do is buy some circuits, wires, chips, and learn how to weld. With these products, you and your kid can do millions of do-it-yourself projects. Robotics clubs. Look into any local robotics programs. Many school and computer vendors sponsor robotics clubs specifically targeted at young hackers, and the leaders are usually top-notch. If you can't find any locally, RoboRealm, roborealm.com/clubs/list.php, and Arik Robotics, arikrobotics.com/clubs.html, are good places to start. Note: another related hobby and club for budding hackers is amateur ham radios. Many hacker friends are also longtime ham radio people. There must be an intellectual link. Capture the Flag contests. Many schools, websites, groups, and security conferences sponsor Capture the Flag contests, where individual hackers or teams compete to see who can successfully hack something first and get the prize. Just type Hacking Capture the Flag contest into any internet search engine, and you'll see dozens of Capture the Flag contests you or your kid can join. The following site shows many different upcoming Capture the Flag contests. ctftime.org/. Training and certifications. Getting training or a certification is a great way to direct youthful hacking exuberance into the right channels. Challenge your kid to prove how good they really are by obtaining a computer security certification, some of which are covered in Chapter 41. Earning a respected all-around first-time hacking certification, such as EC Council's Certified Ethical Hacker, eccouncil.org/certification/certified-ethical-hacker, is a great way to learn and eventually move into a career. In my nearly 30 years of hacking, I've learned something new and valuable from every certification I've earned, which has made me a better hacker. Connect them with a good mentor. Lastly, try to hook them up with someone who has been through their experience and was able to transform their newfound creativity into a legal and lucrative career. If you don't know anyone else, consider me. Roger_Grimes@infoworld.com. I'll be happy to add your kid to the list of people that I mentor. I usually give the same guidance that I provide here, but I can also introduce them to the smarter, good hackers. Most kids mistakenly believe that the black hat hackers are the most clever, intelligent ones. But in any given year, maybe one bad hacker is doing something new and interesting. Everyone else is just following what they did. Unquestionably, the best hackers I've met have consistently been the defenders. It's easy to take a sledgehammer and destroy a car, but it's much harder and more challenging to build that car. Want to impress me? Be the person who builds something that can withstand the constant challenges from hackers. If you suspect that your child or someone else's child might be engaged in unethical or illegal hacking, show them this book. Teenagers who love hacking can always be turned around to the good side. For that matter, so can adults. And my hacking son? He's doing great in life. He's got a great job working with computers, making lots of money. He's a wonderful son, father, and ethical human being. I couldn't love him more. We look back and laugh about the day when it was us versus him in the digital world. He thanks me and his mom for stepping in and providing a little guidance to help him move away from the darker aspects of hacking. Chapter 50. Hacker Code of Ethics. If you do an internet search for hacker ethics, you are more likely to find a glamorized version of so-called hacker rules that embrace the idea that hackers can do anything they want, even perhaps without limits, in the pursuit of whatever they want. Best-selling author Stephen Levy's 1984 book, Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution, amazon.com/hackers-computer-revolution-Stephen-Levy/dp/1449-388-396, introduced the world to one of the earliest versions of hacker ethics. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/hacker_ethic. In a nutshell, almost word for word, it said the following. 1. Access to computers should be unlimited and total. 2. All information should be free. 3. Mistrust authority, promote decentralization. 4. Hackers should be judged by their hacking, not criteria such as degrees, age, race, or position. 5. You can create art and beauty on a computer. 6. Computers can change your life for the better. Levy was sharing, not necessarily agreeing with, what many hackers felt about the early days of hacking. Unfortunately, many hackers took Levy's hacking ethics to mean that the ends justified the means and that even illegal activities were okay. That's like saying robbing a bank or taking someone else's property is okay, as long as you give it away to change your or someone else's life for the better. Hacking without a moral compass can lead to unethical situations and illegality. But more than that, it would hurt us all. Ignoring for the moment that Levy's proclamations were made more than a decade before the information superhighway came into existence, even Levy didn't promote outright lawlessness and unethical activities. Although some of the people in his book did do some ethically questionable things, the majority did not. Most made a better life for themselves and society without doing a single illegal deed. Many have selflessly dedicated their entire lives to enriching the lives of others for almost no monetary remuneration. Where some hackers saw Levy's hacker ethics as a lawless free-for-all, how else is all information free? Most readers and budding hackers saw the beauty of ethical cooperation. The hackers in Levy's book may have started as decentralized, mistrusting free thinkers, but in the end, what they learned, created, and invented changed the whole world for the better. If all information was truly free, that would remove much of the incentive for most of the world's best artists and writers to create the wonderful things they create. Even Stephen Levy wanted to be paid for writing his book. Most hardware vendors and software programmers would not do what they do without being able to make a living in some way. Someone ultimately has to pay the bills for the work that paves the information highway. If creators and owners could never charge for their information and creations, we would have far less information and fewer creations. If we took the original hacker ethic to its foremost strict interpretation without considering moral ethics in the process, we would have a less great society. Indeed, hacking without the ethical consideration for the greater good would simply denigrate society. The culmination of this book is to demonstrate that the best hacking is ethical and legal hacking. Everyone profiled in this book took their amazing mental gifts and used them to better mankind. The most important guiding principle for hacking is that you do no greater overall harm to the world, even if it would give you greater fortune and fame. Put the best ethical outcome ahead of money and glory. This doesn't mean you can't make profit or gain fame, but do so in a legal and ethical way. Today, many computer security training organizations have an ethical code of conduct that you must agree to abide by in order to be certified by them. The most popular hacker code of ethics I can find on the internet is the EC Council Code of Ethics, eccouncil.org/code-of-ethics/. It's a good code of ethics, but a bit too focused on penetration testing. And it's growing a bit long over time, with 19 statements at press time. With that said, the next section provides a solid, concise code of ethics to operate by, both personally and professionally. Hacker Code of Ethics. This is my personal hacker code of ethics, one that I've lived by all my life. And I think it's a good starting point for any hacker looking for ethical guidance. Be ethical, transparent, and honest. It almost goes without saying that following a code of ethics means being ethical. Ethical means trying to do right versus wrong, good versus evil, justice versus injustice. When in an ethical conflict, decide to do what benefits society the most. Be transparent in what you do, being sure to allow either observation by or adequate communication with all stakeholders. Say what you will do, and then do it. Don't break the law. Follow the laws that govern you and your activities. If an ethical issue is making you consider breaking the law, ensure that you have tried everything else reasonably possible and that your actions would likely be seen by most of society as being for the greater good. Most unlawful situations are unlawful because society has determined that everything works better in a particular way, even when you believe you have a powerful justification for breaking the law. Of course, be prepared for living with the consequences of breaking those laws, should you be caught. Get permission. Always get prior documented permission from the owner or their lawful representative before hacking an asset owned or managed by them. No exceptions. Be confidential with sensitive information. Society breaks down without trust. Part of being trustworthy, besides also being ethical, transparent, and honest, means not disclosing sensitive information without prior permission of the owner, especially when that information has been given to you in confidence. In general, the less personal and confidential information you share in life, the more trustworthy people will see you as. I always get a non-disclosure agreement, NDA, signed by new customers. It makes them and me feel better. If you're going to break someone's confidence, make sure it is ethical, legal, and better overall for society for you to do so. Do no greater harm. The Hippocratic Oath should apply to society in general, as well as any companies or customers you are working for. All hackers should follow it. Hackers and professional penetration testers should start every engagement by trying not to cause any harm. Minimize potential disruptions. Always start any operation that could cause disruption to an environment slowly. Testing, testing, testing first. And then use the least disruptive settings of your software if those types of settings exist. If you're performing hacking, always warn customers in writing that your activities could cause unintentional harm to their environment. Also, make no public disclosure of software vulnerabilities without first notifying the software vendor and giving them adequate time to create a patch. Doing otherwise just harms more customers. Conduct yourself professionally. Strive to be professional in all activities and interactions. This doesn't mean you have to wear a suit, but it does mean that you should act in ways that ensure that people find you trustworthy, if not predictable. This all goes back to being ethical, honest, and transparent. Good communication is a big part of being professional. It also means using your real name, or easy-to-find real identity, and not harassing others or their resources. Be a light for others. Finally, be an example for others by leading an ethical hacking life. Use your powers for good and for the overall betterment of society. Show others how your hacker ethics improve the lives of everyone. Let your hacking behavior be driven by a combination of both Levy's hacker ethics and the truly ethical guidelines proposed in this chapter. Declare yourself an ethical hacker and be proud of it. Like all of the people profiled in this book, it's possible to earn a good living and do all the hacking you need to do in an ethical and legal way. The smartest and best minds aren't the hackers, but the defenders who hack the hackers. This concludes Hacking the Hacker by Roger A. Grimes. Narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross. Copyright 2017 by John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2019 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.